Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
All right, guys, what is happening? We are back again. Another episode, D&Ms with Dean, recorded, as always, out of the nest in Burleigh. This is Burleigh Head's newest creative studio. We are in the industrial area, and we are here to make your creative ideas come alive. Whether you want to record video, photo, record a podcast, have a workspace, or run an event, this is your newest creative space on the Gold Coast, and we'd love to have you in. So reach out to the team and come check us out. But now, this podcast today, I got recommended to meet Mark Lucchiari through a mutual friend of mine, and I think she was bang on the money. She reckoned we'd get along like a house on fire, and that's just what happened. The first time I met Mark, when he came in, and instantly we definitely gelled, and we definitely got along, and we definitely carry a lot of the same values. So epic chat. We go into growing up without a father and the struggles of mental health and suicide and how he dealt with that as a young kid. And then obviously my own relation with mental health. So that was really, really good to just relate to both sides of seeing it and then also feeling it at the same time. So we get into that. We get into fighting and how that shaped him as a person. We get into the losses that come with fighting and how that humbled him as a person. And we also get into the accident where he was in a skydiving accident where he got taken out by an actual friend of his that collided with him midair. Now the friend thought he obviously killed his mate because he saw his body falling to the ground with no chute opening. And we go into the different perspective of tragedy and how people view things from different angles and how it affects people's mental health and obviously trauma towards that event. So we unpack a lot, honestly, in this hour and a half, and it's one of those chats where time definitely feels like it slows down. Not slows down, goes faster, sorry. It also kind of slows down at the same time, but I really think you guys will enjoy this chat. Mark's someone that just wants to help people. He's been through a lot of different challenges in his life that has definitely made him a person that can be very useful to others, and he's just kind of got a goal now to be that person for other people, and he sees the value in helping other people. So can definitely relate a lot to that, and I really hope you guys enjoy what Mark's got to say and enjoy the chat. Before we jump into it though, quick word from the sponsors. You guys are eating too many pills in the morning. If you guys are out of routine, get some AG1 in your life. It'll get you in routine. It'll get your immune system feeling good. It'll get your gut health feeling good. It'll get your energy levels up, and it's simple. One scoop, mix it with some water, have it in the morning, and start your day off right. I've been whacking in smoothies. I think I'll do a video soon about like how I put it in and how I mix it together and how it tastes great. But if you guys want to grab some free travel packs, follow the link in the description and you'll get 5 free travel packs and a year's supply of vitamin D. So try it out, see what you think, and let me know. But yeah, perfect to get your morning started right and feel great throughout your day. But now without any further ado, here's the podcast with Mark. Enjoy, guys. anyway, Mike, welcome to the podcast. It's good to have you on here. We've realised that the Gold Coast becomes smaller and smaller every day.
It does.
Mutual friend Vanessa connected us up. I was actually supposed to do a podcast with her about her painting and everything. And while I was at her house, she's like, I got the perfect person for you, and started to kind of explain your story. And then with a bit of research, I've seen you've done a few pods. You've actually mutual friend with Cooper Chapman as well. So it's good to get in and kind of tell, like you're saying, you've got a few different stories. So I don't know which one to dive into straight away.
Yeah.
But how have you been anyway?
Mate, I've been amazing actually. Yeah, life is good. And as you said, the Gold Coast, it is a small place. And Ness, our mutual friend, I've actually known her since year one. We've been, we went to primary school together at Burley Primary here on the Goldie. And so she's one of my longest time friends. Only just actually reconnected. She's only just back in the country recently. And and then Coops and the Goldie, man, it's small. And it's a beautiful place to live. We talked about it before, you know. I'm blessed to be here, and it's a good life.
I was going to say, you can't walk down the street without seeing about 20 of your friends, can you?
Yeah. Used to annoy the crap out of my wife trying to go for a walk down Burley and stopping every 10 minutes.
It almost feels like you're on an episode of Neighbours, hey? When you go down. I thought that the other day. I was at a cafe and a friend rode past and a Vespa gave me a wave another friend came up and got a coffee, and it's just like, it's just this big, happy family environment that this place creates.
It is, man, yeah.
Did you, because you said you came here when you were 5, was there a reason that you moved up here that young, or was there a pull away from Melbourne?
The reason I moved up, we moved up here was family reasons. We were actually kind of had a pretty violent upbringing. My dad, unfortunately, was a bit of a violent man and a bit of domestic violence, and we kind of were coming up to escape and get away from him. And the plan was we were all meant to move up together when things were good, and then that didn't happen, and we ended up getting up here to try to get away and change the life down in Melbourne. And and then we've been here since. It was unfortunate circumstances ended up being one of the best kind of moves of our life, and that's kind of the main reason we come up here, yeah.
Do you remember back then that being apparent in your life, or was that something that you kind of didn't really understand when you were 5?
Totally understand it. It shaped my life. My dad ended up going on and committing suicide, and it literally has made me the man I am today. Every aspect of that, I remember the domestic violence. I remember it all a lot. Unfortunately, I don't actually remember anything else except for that. I have no kind of childhood memories of good times. But in saying that, like, I have, it literally shaped me to who I am, and I would never go back and redo it and change it again. Like, it's just who I am. And sometimes hard times, you know, you can get either play the victim of it, which I did for a long time. And then when I learned to use it as motivation and become a better person, I don't regret one aspect of it, you know, or wouldn't change one bit of it, even though, you know, like most boys, all you want is a dad. I still, to this day, would, you know, do anything to have a dad. But, like I said, wouldn't go back again.
It's funny how you do become the person that, it's like you see what they have kind of done, and it's either you kind of take that on board as being the same person, or you do the polar opposite and use that as an example not to be, in a way.
Yeah.
And then be better. And like you say, it's like those hard times shape you into being who you are now. And obviously in the moment you don't like it, but then looking back you wouldn't change it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. There is that big thing of people playing the victim, or, you know, like, then they use that as an excuse and they become violent and domestic violence, and oh, my dad did it and whatnot. And it's just, I don't know, those people should be more against, for me, you know, it's like, man, well, you know what it feels like, wouldn't you not want that? Like, but yeah, you know, everyone reacts differently to stuff, but that's the way I've taken it to change and be the better person.
Mm. How did you react when he did take his own life?
I kind of ignored it straight away. I think my mum was telling me that I just asked to go outside and play. I was only 5 or just turned 6 when it happened. And then as I got older, I played the victim. I blamed him and what happened on everything that happened to me. You know, I wasn't accountable for what was happening. I was getting into fights all the time. I reacted against men. I didn't like men, any boyfriends that come in. I rebelled against, and yeah, I used it. I used the negativity of it. I used the power of the negativity of it all, and used that to, you know, I wasn't like an absolute mongrel of a person, but I was, I could be ticked off pretty easy. I was very angry, and I was. I was a bit of a bigger and older looking boy as I was getting into my teens and that. So I used to go out and get in a lot of fights with bullies more than thing. I used to love getting in fights with bullies, and that was kind of like my outlet for a while, until I learned to turn that around and use all that negativity for positivity. And, you know, then that was when I started living life.
Yeah, really. You justify it to yourself that it's okay.
Yeah, yeah. But,
and like you say, if you're doing bullies, like, oh, well, they're bullies. It's exactly, okay. Yeah. They deserve it.
Yeah, and then who knows, they could have been at home getting bashed. You know, this is one thing I've learned over the time is, you know, a person might be an asshole, but you don't know his story or her story. You don't know what's going on behind. So you just need to be compassionate and understanding of everyone, no matter how they react, you know, to you or what they're doing to you. Because you just don't know people's stories. Mm. Anyone, the guy that you think's got it all together could be battling demons at home and have the worst, you know, be having the worst time of his life or her life, and you just don't know this.
It's like when someone throws anger at you, instead of throwing it back, you go, like, what's happening to you?
Exactly.
That's, like, you almost, yeah.
That's so powerful, you know, to, that's the thing of, yeah, I'm big and strong, I've been a fighter, and I could, you know, a bully or an asshole of a person is reacting towards me, maybe in a violent way, yeah, I could go back and react in more violence and take that person out, but that's not helping anyone. And it's, you know, what you just said then, so powerful, is just by, hey, man, are you all right? Like, do you need a hug or do you need to chat or something like that? Like, that can diffuse nearly any situation and help everyone, you know. Then he might go home and smile, you know, be better to his wife, and then that goes to his kids and to his dog. And, you know, that ripple effect of just being nice to other humans is so powerful.
It's being the circuit breaker, hey.
Mm,
and that's a hard thing to do, especially in a family of constant, I guess, negative or abuse or violence. And it's like, how do you become that circuit breaker when you literally haven't been taught how to be that?
Yeah, that's very true.
And you almost need to step out of your reality in a way. And obviously you can always learn from books, other people, other environments, other things like that. But yeah, learn how to be that circuit breaker, come in and be different and be okay with being different to what your normal would be in your family. Mm. What do you find your biggest, I guess, inspiration or biggest event or what it was that changed you, where you said you started living and you stopped being that angry person that kind of was a victim that hated the world or hated people or wanted to fight people?
Yeah, I know the turning point, and it was I met my partner that I'm still with now, Paul Dewini. And we met when we were 18, 19. Well, we got together when we were 18, 19. We've known each other since primary school. But we had a young son, and we were together, and we were having trouble. We were about to break up, and both of us had pretty troubled childhoods, and we're like, we really want to try. We don't want to be that single family parent, you know, parents, and we'll try everything. And we're like, let's go to counselling. And we were only 23, I think, at this stage, and we went to counselling, like a marriage counsellor.
And you had a kid at this point?
We had a kid, yeah. We had our first boy. I just turned 20 and my wife was 19 when he was born.
How was that perspective shift when that all...
Oh, man. That was the start of it all. That was the start of a lot of it. It was like, hang on, like, I'm starting to get some understanding of being a dad and looking at the world differently. It was the very start of my mindset changing. I still was a bit, you know, I still was angry and still had all these issues of blaming my dad or what happened to me, you know. And it wasn't really till we went to see a counsellor about our relationship. And as we were leaving, the counsellor was like, hey, you've got a really interesting story. Like, I think you should come back yourself. Like, you know, I think you've got some issues you need to sort out, you know. And I went back in. It was so foreign for me, and being so young too, it was like, man, I don't need a counsellor and fuck this and, you know, all that. And I went back in and seen this guy. It was a guy, and he just listened, and he said, hey, man, you've had a hard life. And it was the first time someone listened to me and said, I understand, you know, like, you're not alone. you should, you know, you've got reasons to be feeling like this, you know. And it was just like, I walked out of there and it was like the world had been lifted off my shoulders. I was just like, holy shit. You know, and I remember him saying, it's like, you can't move forward when you're blaming the past for what's happening to you and not being accountable. Like, and it was just like this light bulb moment. It was like, all right, I'm going to use everything that's ever happened to me bad, or bad that's happened to me, or whatever, all this stuff, I'm going to use it and see the positive out of it, and then started changing. And that was just like, what you see now, what I am now, reverse that 180 degrees is what I used to be, you know. So
pain can be fuel, hey.
It is. And I've had these realizations over my life of stuff still going, you know, like hitting rock bottom. And now I look at it and go, okay, what can I learn out of this? What can I get as motivation? How is this going to make me a better person, you know, instead of playing the victim? It's like, all right, sweet. What's the lesson I need to learn out of this? And as I've got older, I've realized that a lot of this stuff has happened, and now I can be someone that people can lean on. You know, I've had a lot of traumatic incidences and you know, stuff like that. And now I literally know my purpose in life is to help people along this journey, you know, help men as well. Like, it's a big thing is men don't know that you can talk about it, and then it's okay to talk about it and be vulnerable and be open and emotional and passionate. So yeah, now I know, I literally know what I'm here to do and live life to the fullest and help as many people along as I can and share the journey with other epic humans.
And being vulnerable like that, it releases that trauma or stress out of your body. And that's a powerful, like you say, you can't live to your full potential if you're holding on to something that's holding you back. And I had an example of the holding on to stuff, and I've been open about it like a heap of times. But when I was younger, like small country town, very isolated, very lonely, very bullied, all that kind of stuff. And when I was about 11 or 12, I tried to commit suicide and held on to that my entire life until I was 24 or something. And I don't know if you know Jace McAlpine, he runs a podcast called Gypsy Tales.
Yep.
So yeah. I had this real profound moment and I had gotten back to the happiest I've ever been. And I just felt these new emotions of happiness that I'd never felt before. I was just like, I achieved goals in my career. I was around good people. Life was just shining so bright. And I had this urge to like share that I went from that lowest point where I didn't want to be alive to now all I want to do is live. And it was like that thing about, I want to show people that you can go from here to here. And that took me 14 years to get from point A to point B. And I came up here, went on his podcast, opened up, got vulnerable. And the outpouring of people that were just like, oh man, you've helped me in my life. You've helped me see better. Like, I always saw you as this big, happy personality. And now to see that you went through that and you've come back to here, it's like, it gives people hope.
Yeah.
Because it gives them hope that where they are right now, no matter where that is in their life, they can come from that and become something better. And I think people are in a certain point, they get stuck in that, well, he's this person or he's like this. And it's like, no. We all start, not all of us, but a lot of us start in a really bad place and have to put in a lot of work. And it's just, it's like almost giving people the permission to go, you can be there and still get way better than you could ever imagine.
Yeah.
And I think that's what you were saying there. It's like you had to go through all that shit, but by doing that, you become more useful because you become a tool to help other people go through the similar stuff. Do you feel like that's
100%. And it keeps going. Like I thought I was the happiest I'd been and everything's good, and then went back down again and got my ass kicked again, and then even got into that mood like, whoa, why me? And, you know, why does this keep happening? It always happens to me. And started, you know, getting into that victim mindset, and then had another big realization or another change. And then it was like, whoa, hang on, I need this. I obviously need to become stronger. And, you know, so it does keep happening. But, yeah, it's so nice just to speak to people and hear their stories. And a lot of people have amazing stories but are too, I don't know, the word scared, or I don't even know what the word is or why people don't share it. Maybe it doesn't look right.
I know I was scared. Yeah. I was scared about the I don't know if it was judgment, but I just how it was going to be perceived. Mm. But it was like a weight off my shoulder. I felt lighter.
Yeah.
I felt like, oh.
You do, yeah.
100%. Now it can be me. It was just like I had this want to get it out there because I was like, oh, like I've been carrying this around for so long.
Yeah.
And just to let that out, you feel just yourself.
Oh, the therapy is incredible. Yeah. I remember when I first started talking about mentioning depression, you know, like same thing. A lot of people see me as this big, happy guy living life to the fullest and strong and, you know, big, tattooed, strong and all this. And, man, like, I was, you know, getting dark, you know, many times, and I started speaking about it, and then people started reaching out and saying, hey, man, thank you so much. And, you know, it really does, when you see that you can impact people's lives by just being yourself and just speaking the truth, it's so powerful. And because you kind of also think, who am I? Like, I'm just this dude from the Goldie. Like, why does anyone want to know my story, you know? Like, I'm not anyone important, and still might not be anyone important, but I have some good lessons learned, you know? And if that lesson learned can help someone else, boom. There's a bit of impact on the world, and I've made the world a better place somehow, you know? So.
And that's such a important thing. It's just one person is enough. Like, imagine if you pull one person back from the ledge.
Oh, like easy, yeah, yeah.
And I like, we live in a world now where it's so, did I get 1,000 likes? Did I get 1,000 downloads? Did I get 20,000 downloads? Do I have, it's like these massive numbers, and we kind of lose focus of that one.
Mm.
Like, if you put out a podcast and one person listened to it, you'd probably be like, well, that's a failure. That one person might have been about to jump.
Yeah.
And they heard something you said, and now they're not going to do that. That's a positive podcast.
100%, yeah.
But it's not putting, it's this idea. Do you know Rick Rubin?
The name sounds familiar.
He's a really famous producer. He's worked with like Red Hot Chili Peppers, Kanye, like just massive in America. And he's talking about when you produce art, no matter what your art is, do it as like a gift to yourself. And like, if you produce it and you enjoy it and it feels good to make and you're happy with it, just the fact that you're putting it out to the world is a win.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how it's received. You can't control how someone else receives your art. And if they don't receive it the same way as you feel about it, that shouldn't change how you feel about it. That changes how they feel about it. And it's being okay with putting stuff out there that is just like, well, I'm putting it out there, so I'm happy enough. I like it enough to put it out there.
Yeah.
But then, well, that's a win.
It is.
That's good enough.
It is a win. It's very. I like what you said there, though. You got to be happy with it, and then people aren't going to like everything you put out there. And then to be not be affected by it is a hard thing. But once you start finding that, and then you start really becoming who you are and putting all your stuff out there, I don't mean out there on social media, but just being who you really are, everything starts working for you more and more anyway, you know, like everything, that positive attraction. And, you know, if you love your artwork so much, you'll find that that's going to make other people love it. I don't know. It's something strange about that. The more in love with everything you're doing or comfortable with it you are, like, the more people seem to be attracted to it as well, or to you, you know.
And when they see you being genuine, like really genuine, they go, okay, I want a piece of whatever that guy's doing, because it's just genuine. It's him.
Yep.
It's authentic. It's no matter what that may be, even if it's not something you're fully invested in, just seeing someone passionate and enthusiastic about a thing will draw you towards that thing, whether it be something that you're not actually into. Like, look at like Conor McGregor, for example. Like, he got so famous for being authentically him and drew so many people into the UFC and fighting that wouldn't normally have been fans of that. But it's that authenticity and that genuineness that that person brought, and obviously a bit of like glitz and glam and well-spokenness and all those other things that come along with it. But if you can be that person, no matter if that's in a small job or a small sporting circle, like, that will attract people to be around you, and the right people at that as well.
Mm, yeah.
Do you feel like that's kind of how you try and live now, is that person that kind of just by being you and being so outgoing, uplifting, exciting, the right people seem to get drawn into you?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And I'm still learning. I'm 45 now and still learning who I really am, you know. And, you know, I've done a couple of ceremonies over the last few years, you know, going into the psychedelic ceremonies, and really started discovering who I really am, becoming vulnerable and stripping away that ego. And yeah, the more I'm discovering who I really am and allowing myself to be that person, the more amazing humans I'm attracting, the more good that I'm attracting. And yeah, it 100% is...
What do you think the biggest thing you've learned out of doing some of those ceremonies?
To be vulnerable, to be vulnerable, to love myself, you know, realize everything is how is it meant to be. And... yeah, just really like stripping away my ego and having what they call an ego death, and just really discovering, like, I know who I am. Like, I know my purpose on earth, you know. Like, it's not many people unfortunately get to know that, know who they truly are and know their intentions and all that. And I know I'm on the right path, and I know who I really am, and it's a beautiful thing. and a very powerful thing as well.
Do you also believe that the ego, because I get this, I get the idea of the whole ego death, do you think it's also an important tool to have an ego at the same time?
For sure.
To guide you through life?
For sure. It's a protection. It's a very strange thing, the ego, you know, and it's a very fine line too between self-love and loving yourself. I'm still, like I said, I'm still discovering all this, and as I'm becoming more open and more in touch with myself, you know, I'm discovering all these different levels of each thing. But yeah, I feel ego is super important. Like, it is who, it's not easy who you are, but it is maybe who the world see you a bit more as, and it's your drive, it's your, you know, it's a lot of things. But yeah, I think it is very important. Like, as much as having an ego death, you need your ego to
it's can still pop up. Pops up and bites you on the ass every now and again.
Yeah, that's all right.
I think that's the thing, people like when they say, oh, I've had an ego death, I'm like, yeah, but it's reincarnation as well. It can come back and go again. It's not one of those things that you don't just solve the problem and it's solved forever. It comes and goes. Yeah. It's like ebbs and flows with it all.
Yeah, for sure. And the ego death thing, like I said, it's just being able to let go and release yourself from this conscious world, you know, and be everything and nothing at the same time. And it's a crazy experience that enhances not only your inner soul, but enhances your ego as well, you know. Mm. So, it's a wild, wild thing, the old psychedelics.
Have you not always done those, but have you done those for a while? Is there a turning point with that as well, where you kind of lent more into them to see what you got out? Because when I do psychedelics, I see it pretty much every time I take a lesson away as something I can pull out of that experience. And I normally do it to get something, not always, but there's sometimes when I try not to do them if I'm down or not feeling that great. I don't think that's a good time. I feel like then you're searching for something. But I like to do them obviously when you're feeling good, but there's still certain lessons that you can pull out of each time. I'll get something. And it almost, I don't know if you feel this, it almost takes you out of yourself and puts it in a bit of a third perspective, and you see what you're doing and like zooms you out. You're like almost like your face is up against the wall and it pulls you back and you go, oh, that's why I'm not going anywhere. I'm up against the wall. But you don't see that until you kind of separate yourself from yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, no, for sure. Like, most of my, you know, like psychedelic journeys have been going for as a medicinal, going for, you know, a purpose, going in and seeing, you know, it's kind of come. Most of my, like, I'm talking DMT as well, 5-MeO, going to do a ceremony. It comes at the right time. You know, it's been offered many a times. I'm like, oh, no, I don't need it now. And then I'll get offered and be like, yes, this is the right time. And yeah, very, very powerful. The use of psychedelics is so underused or under, you know, looked at, I suppose. And like even myself, it's only been about 7 years that I did my first DMT journey. And before that, I kind of looked at it as, you know, when I was younger, I might have dabbled in a little bit of acid and stuff like that, and it wasn't my thing. I was like, psychedelics, you're a hippie, you'll have it, you'll never come out of it, you know, all that kind of mainstream
media. How was your headspace when you did do that? Can you think back to how your headspace was when you were doing the like acid and those other psychedelics? Because it obviously put you off for some reason.
Yeah, well, I wasn't, you know, at that stage, I was getting into fights and all that stuff. And I'm talking when I was, you know, 18 to kind of 22, so very young, very dumb, very aggressive, very full on, I suppose. And just definitely not in the right space to be taking psychedelics at that that time, really. Yeah.
I've got a concept that I've played around with for a while now, but I believe most drugs, not all drugs, are kind of like keys. Now, you have a heap of different rooms in your brain, and by just say being around your family, cleaning your room, tidy house, happy wife, stretching, exercising, every time you do something, that's you cleaning up something in that room. So if you're again, living to your values, what you need to do, what you believe is your purpose, that's cleaning these rooms. So then when you take something like acid, ayahuasca, DMT, that key opens that door and you can go and enjoy that room. Now, if you've got a messy room and you open a door and go in, what do you want to do? You want to clean it. So you imagine trying to clean up this entire room and you're rushing around. That's why I say when people have like a bad trip or a bad experience, I'm like, your room's not clean. And you're trying to clean it in a point when your mind's already all over the place. It's like you're going into something and trying to fix it like on the run, where it's like if you actually are okay within yourself, when you do, you do that drug or use that key to enter that room in your own brain, it's like, oh, I can enjoy this. I can sit in this. I can feel this. And normally that's when you get something out of it.
Yeah. And yeah, I definitely, every time I've gone and done a journey, I definitely have been in a pretty good headspace. It'd be scary to go there with a very messy room. And I have seen people go there and they have got something good out of it, you know. But yeah, me personally, I definitely would want to keep that room nice and clean before I get in there.
I think it's dangerous when you do a drug to try and get something. It's like you're using it for almost not what I believe it was put there for. Like, I think it should enhance how you feel. And obviously there's sometimes where I've seen people as well and being sometimes like you'll be in a bit of a bad headspace and you will take something and it will kind of trigger something that will change your entire mood and make you feel a lot better. But I think it's dangerous because then I feel like you'll keep going back to that. And it might work once and it won't work twice. And I think that can really, that's, I guess, a slippery slope with addiction. If you're, well, I took this and I felt better, so I'll take it again. I don't feel better, I'll take another one. And then you can kind of go down that path of addiction, I guess, with that mindset. But, and yeah, even saying this, like, it's not everything is for everyone either. Like, obviously people are going to react so differently to an assortment of different things. Like, I know people that can't drink alcohol, they become an absolute horrible person. And then other people that they just become loving, and it's just that different relationship with different substances.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
When you were, we kind of got off track a bit with the, when you were obviously started going to counselling when you were 20 or 19?
Yeah, I was, about 23 when 23? We went to counselling. Yes, yeah. I think my young fella was about 3 and going through a rough patch, and we went and seen the counsellor for our relationship. And that's when, I went back and seen the counsellor by myself and kind of just had the first time that someone had listened to me, and just the first time I'd been made aware that the feelings I was having were normal and kind of that it was okay to have those feelings and that you can use them in different ways, you know. And like I said, that's what I started doing. And yeah, from then on, just it changed me. And I've had to keep working constantly. You know, you can never, like we were kind of saying before, it's not just one fix and you're done. You know, it's just you keep evolving and changing and just learning new tools as well to keep everything under control, you know, and or control or guide it or live a good life, you know, all these new tools. And there's so much information out there now. There's so many different things to do, and there's so many people talking like yourself and making people aware of other people who, you know, have been down, and then you hear what tools they do and you can use that. And, you know, so the information out there is incredible now and just keeps evolving, I suppose, of what you can do to keep on top of things. Yeah.
Do you remember when you saw her? It was a her, wasn't it?
It was a guy.
When you saw him, was there tools that he gave you to really accelerate the healing or the new mindset?
Yeah, at the time, that was all it was as I said before, when he said to me, you're focusing on the past, you're using the past as an excuse. And that was the biggest thing I got out of it was like, I'm not being accountable for everything that's happened to me. I'm blaming everything bad that happens to me on that I had a, you know, messed up childhood, that my dad killed himself. You know, I was blaming everything that happened to me, whether it had nothing to do with that, on that situation, you know. And when he said that you need to forgive your father, that was the big thing, was, you know, need forgiveness of what he done. Imagine what he was going through, you know. Of course he loved you, and you know, imagine what he was going through to take his own life. And once I started doing that and realizing that, I was like, whoa, you know, I do forgive you, and let's move on. And that was it. Then I just started moving on. And then over the time, I've learned more and more techniques, or, you know, things that I do now. And like I said, I'm still constantly evolving.
I heard a thing, it's like if you're blaming them, you're going the wrong way. If you're blaming yourself, you're going the right way. If you're blaming no one, you're there.
I like it. That's really good.
So it's like in those moments, you probably got there. Like it's no one's fault and that's okay.
Yeah.
So obviously you've just had this change. Was there like an kind of a passion or a goal? Because obviously you're in skydiving. Was that something that you attached or was there a thing that you felt like you attached to? Once you had this new mindset, was there a goal you kind of like, okay, I want to go after this, and that was like part of the focus in the healing process as well?
Yeah, definitely sports, like just sports and a lot of extreme sports is what I did start focusing on a lot. Like I've always been sporty, you know, I was playing footy at the time, then I went into wakeboarding and kind of did that for quite a while, and then kind of got into Muay Thai, into fighting, the combat sports. And that was one of the big things. I got addicted to that. And the addiction to that was the physical and the mental side of it, of just pushing your limits, training. Like you feel like you're reaching, you're like, that's all I can do. And then you push past that. And then you start realizing your potential and you're realizing that, you know, it's unlimited, really. Like the human body and mind can just push so far. And so the mental challenge of fighting, of, you know, you're not, you got to beat yourself before you beat your opponent, you know. The opponent's the easy part at the end. Like the fight of yourself, and each fight camp was different as well. And each time you went into a fight camp, of what the situation was, of how your life was at that moment, you know, battling yourself and the self-doubt and all that. And then you're overcoming that and then beating your opponent or even losing to your opponent and then learning the lessons from that one and moving on. That, I became so addicted to that. And I was skydiving at the same time. I'd started my skydiving kind of course at the same time. But that kind of got put on the bit of the back burner as well because I was fighting full time. But, yeah, the skydiving, that big rush of adrenaline was another outlet for me as well.
What do you think the biggest thing that fighting taught you was?
To be humble. To be humble. To lose and be humble and learn from it. Yeah, it's a crazy thing. Like my first six or so fights, I won every one and I was like, the man. And then I lost and I just lost to a better guy, you know. Like I didn't do anything. I was trying to look for these excuses and I was just like, all right, well, look, this guy was just better than me. And just to be humble with that and be accepting, I suppose.
Be okay with your losses.
Yeah, just to be okay with it and realize that you learn so much more from losing. Like from failure, you learn like so much more. So not that I wanted to keep on failing and losing, but it definitely was like, okay, I that was good. I needed that. And here we go. And then went on another winning streak and then went on a big losing streak. And, you know, oh man, it was some crazy times. It's a harsh sport, the fighting game.
I think I like it. Someone said, you either win or you learn.
Yeah. Yep. And, I don't even know which one's more powerful, winning or learning. Like I feel learning sometimes is, you know.
This comes back to in the moment you hate it, but then you realize you get way more out of it.
Yeah.
So at the same time, it's just like it's prolonged gratification for a situation.
Yeah, yeah, I like it.
In that, because me and my mate were chatting because he did a professional boxing fight and we were talking about like, again, being humbled. And it's almost like everyone should be put in a fight situation at some point in their life. Like, you know, how in Europe and stuff, there's subscription. How do you say when you get put in
the army? Yeah.
Anyway, they should almost, when you get to 18 or 19, you've got to just do at least like two fights. Because I think everyone would do a really better job with life. They probably got hit in the face a couple of times to,
man,
be like,
bang on. I totally am up for this. I think it should be part of the school curriculum. I feel that you should have to train for a fight. That's the whole thing of training to fight another man, another human who's training to fight you. And it's just, there's no other feeling like it. And the lessons you get, like you said, your mate did that, was it a fight like a pro?
Boxing fight,
yeah. And when you go to them and you see these guys that start it and they start with no confidence and they train and they go through, like I was saying, these ups and downs of emotions, of self-doubt, and then the realization that they can do it. What you learn from a fight camp and then the actual fight is you can't teach that stuff at school. I feel that everyone should have to have a fight and then you should have to jump out of a plane as well. And then that's your kind of introduction. Say, here's life. This is what life's really about, you know, not freaking Shakespeare or whatever else, algorithm or all the other crap.
Stuff you can learn. I think like Mike Tyson, I love the quote when he's like, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face. And just take that and put that to life. Like everyone has a plan in life until you get hit in the face. And that could be someone passing away. That could be losing your job. That could be your girlfriend leaving you. That could be you getting overweight. Like that's your punch in the face.
Mm.
It's like, how do you deal with that setback now?
Yeah.
And if you do it in a fighting sense, that will directly show you how your body goes into fight or flight and how you're going to react.
Yeah.
And then you become more useful because you actually felt those emotions. And I guess what you said when you're in those first fights and you're on top of the world, your shit don't stink, you're winning, and then humbled. And you're like, okay, do I want to keep doing this? Why did I lose? What can I do better? And you start putting those things in place to then become a better fighter slash person.
Yeah.
And do you find with that, what do you think your biggest challenge with fighting was, or your hardest, not a hardest fight, but hardest probably, yeah, fight and maybe challenge with fighting?
The mental, just fighting myself. Battling the demons of the self-doubt.
Yeah, do you feel like you weren't good enough a lot of the time?
All the time. The self-doubt, the harder you train. Like sometimes I'd be a week out from a fight and it'd just be like crumbling. It's like I'm getting unfitter. Like how is it possible? You know, I'm not losing weight. There's just so many aspects of it. And it's like, you know, it's impossible to get unfitter. Like you're training for the fight. You're training every day, twice a day. But you're like in your mind, you're like I'm getting unfitter. I'm not going to win. And, you know, like, yeah, those lessons are so crazy. And even, like, the fights themselves, like, winning a fight, knocking a guy out first round is pretty satisfying. But to be in a fight, go the distance, be knocked down yourself and then get up and win is, like, the fights that you were losing and then you won, those ones were the ones that really satisfied everything, and they're the ones you learned the most from and got the most out of, because you not only were battling yourself, because then you know once you might be fighting the guy, you might be winning, you're all good, your confidence is up, then he starts getting on top of you, then he knocks you down, and then you're like, whoa man, like you're not only lifting your physical body off the ground, you're lifting your soul, like you're like, man, like shit, here we go, and it's back up, and it's straight away your mind's like, you can't do this, stay down, you know, you know he's better than you in this and that, and then just learning to battle that and beat that is the biggest thing I ever got out of fighting. Like that was the biggest, you know.
Overcoming adversity.
Yeah, stuff the titles and the whatever it is, you know, it was the stuff I learned out of it about myself
and
how far I can go. And the same with the training. I think I was addicted to the training more than the fighting. I'm just pushing myself to the limits. It was
you realize that we scratch the surface of our own potential.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Like, that's what I started getting to. I started training the boys like Harry Bink and Sawley and all the boys. I started doing strength conditioning and I just love pushing people. People, oh, I can't do that. I can't, you know, oh, that's as much as I can do. And then seeing them push past that boundary. Like when you see another human go past what they thought was, their potential or what they thought their limit was, and then see them go past that is so satisfying. And then when you're part of that, of helping them get past it and they have that realization, you're like, yes.
I think you just put the one, you can probably do one more. And you go, yeah, probably. And you go, okay, well, you probably do one more and you can kind of almost keep using that.
Oh, yeah.
Like you always hear about like ultra runners and stuff and they'll get to a point where they'll just be broken. But they're like, well, you can probably do one more step. And they do one more step. Like, oh, you probably do another step. And then they just start walking. And this might be in like a 200-mile race or something, but you can, and then they'll probably get a bit more momentum going. Then, okay, we can start jogging again. But it's like that, just aim for that one more kind of thing. Mm. And if you get that, then aim for another one.
Yeah.
Stop looking at the finish line and start looking at the next step you're going to do.
Yeah.
And I think that's powerful to kind of center yourself back into, okay, well, instead of this huge, massive bite, you can just have a tiny little nibble of that next challenge and then go, okay, and get through it. And how rewarding was that, seeing these guys find their new potential?
Yeah, it's addictive. That's what I started, you know, I set out to do. I used to love training people. I used to love, and it's gone to all aspects in life now. I love helping people and getting them out of situations or pushing them further, making them become a better human, a better person. I just love helping in any way. And yeah, that's how satisfying it was, is that I literally, is what I kind of love to try and do now, is just help people become better and push people past their limits. My poor boys probably don't like that as much as I do. Like, you know, I'm for sure. You know, I've support. I call it support. They say pushing them, but pushing them to their utmost limits.
How is that? Hey, because obviously you would have been a super young dad and you wouldn't have had your dad as guidance to then put that knowledge into your kids. Was that a bit of your kind of, how did that feel trying to be that person when you kind of didn't have that role model and then obviously knowing what you went through as a kid at the same time?
Yeah, that's an interesting one because it really was. I had no idea what a dad was meant to be, you know. When my mum had boyfriends and that, I didn't have anything to do with them. You know, I taught myself to shave. I did everything myself, literally, you know, in manhood style things, you know. And I just gave them what I kind of thought a dad should be. And I definitely haven't done it right. You know, like I said, I've been pretty hard on my boys sometimes of pushing them and stuff like that. But I'd look at other people, families, and see what they do and stuff like that, or what dads is kind of doing. And yeah, it was hard. It was tough to know what was right. But I just done what I felt was right, and like I said, what I kind of wanted or expected out of a dad is what I'm trying to give my boys. And
because you can go the other way with that as well, and give them too much.
Yeah.
Like I've seen people do that where they'll have nothing and then they'll get everything and then they'll kind of give their kids everything. But that's got its downsides as well.
It does. It's so tricky. Like even with my boys, like they're definitely not soft, but they didn't grow up hard like my wife had, and I, you know, through violence and all that stuff. And they're quite emotional. It's like, oh man, they wish they could harden up sometimes. It's like, whoa, hang on. No, like you don't want them to have your life. Like, trying to give them a better life. And, you know, we're doing all right in life now. We've got, you know, a bit of money. Like, when we were younger, we didn't have much money. And it's like, oh, hopefully they respect it enough. And, you know, like, it's very hard. It's very fine line of everything. And no, there's no right or wrong way, I suppose. I've definitely learned that. Yeah, everyone's different, you know. And my older son's 25 now, and younger son 16, and they're both incredible humans, so we've obviously done something right there. It's kind of worked out.
Do they fight?
My oldest boy did. He was Aussie champ at 13. He had his first fight at 7. He was, you know, one of Australia, he was, yeah, Aussie's best, and was, you know, on the world stage. We were living in Thailand for a while there, fighting over there. And yeah, he's still this, he's only 25 now, and he's still got the potential to come back and, you know, take over if he wanted to. But yeah.
How is that relationship between, because I can obviously imagine you were help coaching him at the time when he's obviously 7, but how was that relationship? Because I find it interesting, the whole father coach dynamic with sports, because I had a sports psych on here the other day, and it's that you're playing two roles and they can get bled together for a kid.
Yeah.
And it's like, are you coach right now or are you dad? And if I don't win this match, am I getting dad's love or coach's disapproval?
Yeah, it's super hard, yeah. And then I went one step further. I was his boss at work too, and he, you know, kind of, it's hard, yeah. And like we fought together on the same show a few times as well. So, yeah, we clashed, and I feel that it might, as a big part of that, has led to him not fighting anymore. I think maybe I did push him too much, or maybe I was a bit hard on him, or whatever it was, or whether it, maybe he just wasn't going to be a fighter always, you know. It definitely very hard. And you see all the time now, you see, you know, world champion boxers and stuff like that with a father-son kind of duo, or father-daughter, whatever it is. And, you know, they'll be together and then they're not together, and I don't think there's any real successful ones that have been successful the whole entirety of someone's career.
I can just think of Floyd. Is his dad?
Yeah,
Mayweather.
Yeah,
they've been together most of the time.
Yeah, they had fights without him as well. Like he actually coached someone against Floyd at one stage. I think it
really?
Was. Yeah, yeah. Oh, who was it? I think he coached someone against him. Yeah, like it's. I don't think there's one that has been smooth sailing.
Not a linear process. It's always been bumpy. How would that feel?
Yeah,
having coaching someone against your own son.
Yeah, yeah. It's it is. It's a real hard thing to juggle, but it's also something amazing as well. Like, you know, coaching your son and having him fight, and but you know, you being the responsible guy in the corner, and a couple of our good friends, the Pudu tribe, they're my son and Chris's son Eddie, they fought three times, and when they first fought, they were only like 7 years old, and you know, two fathers. He was his coach as well, so two fathers on the corner of the ring, looking across the ring at each other, and there's kids about to punch on, and yeah, the boys were incredible. Eddie was, you know, him and Keems were on the same level. They were 7-year-olds having some of the most technical fights ever, you know, and we're still to this day good friends. They have fought each other three times. They were like made for each other. My young fella's nickname was the Iceman, and Eddie's name was the Heat. So it was the Heat versus the Iceman, and mate, they had some incredible battles. But the respect me and Chris, Eddie's dad, got, you know, is second to none of what you know can have for another man.
Was he a fighter as well?
Chris was, yeah, when he was younger as well.
Have you guys ever fought? No. That would be, same card.
Yeah, that'd be an interesting one. And, yeah.
Have you got any fights coming up, or you?
No, I'm done. I retired in 2016. I don't even really spar much anymore, yeah. I actually have been missing it a little bit lately, but I had my last fight in 2016, and it just consumes your life. Fighting, just literally training 6 days a week, twice a day, dieting all the time, you're grumpy, it's just everything, your mind is just consumed with the next fight, and it doesn't allow you to do much else, you know.
It's very tunnel vision.
It's very selfish, it's a very selfish sport. Everything gets put on the back burner, including family, you know. So, in 2015, we were moving back to Australia from Thailand, and my wife said, I'm done, had enough, and I agreed. And then in 2016, there was a big competition. I come out of retirement to do that, and kind of won that and finished on top, which was, you know, doesn't happen very often in the combat sports. And I hung up the gloves, and that was it, was done. And been pretty content since. I got right back into skydiving, right back into rock climbing, and all my other sports that get put on the back burner, surfing and all that, and just enjoyed life, because when you're fighting, you don't get to enjoy it very much.
It comes with a certain level of stress, doesn't it?
Yeah, like, and I think all sports, like when you're an elite athlete at anything,
and there's always, I think, I guess extreme sports have that just extra little bit of risk involved. Like obviously you can get hurt playing football or doing something, soccer or whatever, but I think, like, say fighting, when you got a guy trying to take your head off, or like Harry Bing, for example, like freestyle motocross, like you don't have much room for error.
No.
So that extra bit of anxiety and stress that you live with constantly is, it's not debilitating, but it's always there.
Yeah.
It's like that thing that you can't escape from. And it's like, you're almost trapped in your own mind all the time about, oh, okay, I'm fighting this guy, he's a southpaw, he's going to be doing this. And you're at like a family lunch or something that's floating around there. Yeah. And you're like, how do I get this out? And it's obviously not until you retire from it that you go, oh, man, like, it's all good kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you reckon that was a kind of not like a relieving moment, but you were okay and felt good from that call?
I was good. I really, and when I first retired in 2015, I probably wasn't that content with it. I probably wasn't that, you know, and then the tough man comp came and I got to finish on top, and that was a big part to play with it. You know, I've seen guys retire on a loss, and all they want is that next one, you know, and can't let it go. I also had other sports to go into, which made it a lot easier as well, you know, to get back into skydiving and climbing and stuff like that. Otherwise, you know, it could be a downward spiral, and you see so many athletes retire, and, you know, because we're always chasing that, you know, that, like, you know, the competitiveness, you know, or that challenge. And you see so many athletes retire and not be good, get very depressed and put heaps of weight on, and yeah, it's a hard thing.
So once you give yourself the allowance to, oh, well, I'm not doing it anymore, I can do, like, eat that and do that, and you almost feel like you've been so strict on yourself that you finally got some leg room, and you're like, well, I'm going to use it. I'm going to lean into that.
Yeah.
And then people, like you say, turn to drinking, to a lot of other different things to, I guess, fill that void that the sport's created.
Mm.
Do you follow UFC much at all?
I do, yeah.
Do you look at someone like a Tony Ferguson now, who I think he's on like a 6 or 7 losing streak, and someone like that, like that's almost the. I saw this thing the other day. It's like the harsh reality is you're either going to go out like a GSP as a champion, or Tony Ferguson, who's on 7 losses in a row. And do you see someone like that and go, okay, I'm glad I went out on top and not?
Yeah, for sure. Because there is a lot more Tony Fergusons than GSPs. You know, like there's so many guys that go out on losses and more, you know, and just keep trying to get it. And look, I do get it too that sometimes that's your income, you know, and that's your only way of income, and you might not be financially set up enough to get out of it and might not have any idea of what you're going to do after that. So they might know that it's over for them and they're only doing it for the money at that stage, which is sad.
It's also your identity as well. And I guess with you, you had several other identities in skydiving, rock climbing, surfing. So it's like without the fighting, I'm still all these things. Where I guess a lot of fighters, if without the fighting, who am I?
That's very true. Yeah, I didn't even look at it like that. You know, I got to reinvent myself straight away after it and straight in, you know, hardcore rock climbing and back into jumping every day, and then that all of a sudden that's who I am and the fighter's gone. It's very interesting that if you do only have one sole sport, that is who everyone perceives you as and who you see yourself as, who your ego thinks you are as well, I suppose. And it's hard to let go of that, for sure.
It becomes so it just becomes you. It becomes your whole thing. And I think that's why when people, like you said, do retire and they don't have that next outlet, like, well, who am I? Who am I without the sky,
exactly,
without the fighting, or who am I without the bike?
And unfortunately, don't get to evolve, because that's only one part of you, and you can use that to become someone else. And yeah, you know, learning to evolve and adapt is such a unique and powerful tool to have, and just keep evolving and reinventing yourself. And you know, it goes right into relationships too. You know, you keep reinventing yourselves and, you know, evolving as a couple. I think people get stuck sometimes as evolving as one. Like, where does this couple, we're going to evolve together, but one person might evolve and the other one, you know, faster than the other one. You've got to be accepting of that and aware of it, I suppose.
I heard this thing the other day. It's a friend was like, 1 + 1 = 3. And this other guy said, no, 1 + 1 = 11. And it's like you say, you got someone that will elevate you so much more. And you said, obviously, with your wife, that's something that you felt happened and pulled you towards who you should have been.
Yeah.
And it took you to 11 instead of just...
100% took me to 1,011.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and we're still going. I'm so thankful and grateful for my wife. Yeah, she's incredible.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So now you've gone to the skydiving, because I want to get onto, obviously, is the movie launched or is it about to launch?
We're about to launch. Yep. We've just released the official trailer, and I'm probably looking at doing our premiere around June. So at the moment, we're just kind of circulating it through all the film festivals and letting it do its thing. It's really exciting times, actually. And we're so new to this scene. We didn't start this project going, oh, we're going to make a documentary and it's going to be pretty well received. And it just kind of evolved. And we haven't really been able to wrap our heads around how the potential of what it is, you know, at the moment. And it's all happening just recently. This is all new and super exciting. We've showed the film to some prominent Australian kind of industry, film people in the film industry and award-winning documentary makers, and their minds have been blown. So it's interesting
exciting
to see how
times.
It goes. Yeah.
So we'll kind of take it back. So you've gone into skydiving now. You're obviously not fighting anymore, and this is obviously your new passion, and you've into that. And then what happened, or do you want to talk us through the process of what happened with, obviously, what the film's kind of not fully based around, but the kind of main part about the accident you're in?
So the accident, obviously, the film, like you said, it's not based around this skydiving accident, but the accident is the start of it all. This is
so much more to it, but that's kind of
the
catalyst to it.
So we had a skydiving accident, me and one of my buddies, 3 years ago. I was knocked out. He took me out, knocked me out, and
this is midair.
Midair, yeah. We were at probably 10,000 feet. We're on a jump, what we call an angle jump, where we all fly across the sky on an angle. So you're kind of pushing yourself across the sky. And there was 18 of us on the jump. And as you can imagine, it probably takes a long time for 18 people to leave the plane. By the time the last person leaves, you know, the first group that have left are a long way down. So the last person has to essentially dive down to the group. And, my buddy was diving down to the group and just mistimed everything and come through the group too fast and took me out. And I copped a knee to the back of the head and totally KO'd me. The first time I've actually been knocked out unconscious.
How's that fights for?
Yeah, that's what I always say to Benny. I'm like, you got the title, mate. You come get the belt. You knocked me out, the first person. And just luckily, there's some very smart people in the world who have invented a little device that goes on our parachutes called an AAD. And it's kind of all set that if you fall through a certain altitude at a certain speed, it registers that you should be going a lot slower now, and it fires your reserve out for you. You don't have to do anything, it fires it out. Now, it's in the last kind of line of defense. You don't want to ever use it, but it's there for that last line of defense. It might save your life, it might not, because it's set quite low. It's set low enough that it won't go off if you have a delayed opening of your main canopy in a normal time. But it's meant to open and open in time for you to save you, and mine did. And my canopy opened only kind of 30 odd meters above from the ground, and you know, a couple of second canopy ride and hit the ground, and that was just the start of it. That was the I hit the ground, and Benny, the guy who hit me, he thought he'd killed me at the time, and you can imagine he'd opened up his canopy quite high in the air and thought he'd killed me, and the thoughts that went through his head straight away were like, I've just killed someone, a mate. You know, I don't deserve to live. And he was considering flying his parachute out to the ocean right then and there and killing himself. And it's been a long journey kind of recovery for him. He kind of sustained a lifelong injury. He busted his leg up pretty bad and will never, you know, his knee will never be the same. He's back now skating and surfing and, you know, he's back doing everything, but the injury will be there forever. The reminder of it, you know, all the stuff that comes along with, you know, causing an accident and making a mistake, all the human reactions that you, the normal feelings that you get from it. And that's what we really dive into with the film is the recovery from a traumatic incident like this, the effect that it has on everyone involved, people on the jump, people that have seen it, wives, friends, family. And we really start touching into that mental health and getting the conversation started about men's mental health and mental health in you know, just by itself, you know. It's very interesting. It's very exciting. Like I said, it was just, we thought, look, what are we going to do? We've got this footage, you know, this is 3 years ago or 2 years ago when we kind of like, maybe we should do something with the footage. It's gnarly footage of an accident. And then it just, the story evolved and evolved and evolved. And now we've got this absolute masterpiece of a pretty inspirational story.
So you have the actual footage of the accident itself?
Yeah, well, we all wear cameras, and there was 18 of us on the jump, so there's a lot of different angles. A couple of the boys even followed me down and tried to get to me, like you'd seen, like, you know, a Point Break movie or something like that, and like tried to get to me and couldn't, and you know, there's some pretty confronting footage.
To try and open your chute.
Yeah, or do something. They're not really sure. There's no right or wrong thing to do. We fly pretty small canopies. If he'd actually got to me and pulled my parachute might have opened up and I could have flown out to the ocean, or I could have spiraled in, because our canopies are quite small, you know. If you're not controlling it, or your weight's on one side, it can make me spiral and I could spiral down and, you know, wouldn't survive that.
Could be worse, yeah.
So many things could have happened. All the right things, it all went well, because here I am.
because this is one thing you said there, it's like your mate was obviously conscious for the whole thing and he thought he just killed you. And I guess that's the big point here is, in an accident, I guess you're looked at as obviously the victim of that accident of being hit, but obviously you're unconscious, you're not present for any of this.
So I do come to, yeah.
Oh, you do come to?
I do come to, yeah.
When you're on the ground?
No, I come to as not far from the ground. I knew I was about to die, yeah.
How was that when you came back to reality?
Yeah, it was interesting, because I actually came to probably like 5 or so seconds after being knocked unconscious, and I was in a complete and utter dream state. You know those dreams? I explained it in the documentary, you know, the dreams where you're trying to yell out, or, you know, you're trying to scream out and you can't, or you're trying to do something and you can't. that's what it was like. I kind of knew I was skydiving. I thought I was having a dream about skydiving. I couldn't roll over, and then I start coming to a little bit more, and I start having the realization. I'm like, I'm going in, which in skydiving terms is I'm hitting the ground. I'm about to die. And yeah, it was a pretty big realization. It was like, oh, I'm going in. And I thought of my wife and my boys, and thought of everything, you know, kind of, I was like, this is it. I'm about to die. And I actually had a beautiful sense of peace and contentment. I was like, oh, this is it. I'm content. And yeah. And then all of a sudden I had a little bit of this fighting urge. It was like, hang on, not yet. Like, you know, don't give up yet. And I reached behind, because I'd actually, in all the confusion of me, I'd started doing my emergency procedures. With the emergency procedure of skydiving, you can cut away, which then cuts away your main parachute. So you pull a cable, cuts away your main parachute, and then you pull your reserve. And I'd actually done my cutaway. And in the footage, you can see me passing my cutaway handle back and forth in front of me, because I'm obviously so dazed and confused. Yeah, no, yeah. I'm trying to compute what's going on. And I remember having this thought. I'm like, oh, like my emergency procedures haven't worked. I'm thinking my canopy must be stuck on my back. And I started trying to reach up and trying to maybe pull it off or do something. And that's when my AAD fired and my canopy opened. But yeah, you know, like, this is only like milliseconds, but the thoughts that went through my head was like an eternity. Like, it's really strange.
Talk about that at peace point.
Yeah, it was just, it's such a hard feeling. I was about to die, and I was at peace with it all. I think a really big part to play with this, I don't know whether it is or not, but I really do feel, is that I had, you know, done a journey not long before this and realized that death is not, like, we are everything and nothing at the same time. I don't know, it's so hard to explain. Like, you know, I reached total eternity and bliss in my DMT journey. And I know there's so much more than this, and this is just a small speck of eternity and everything. And I feel that might have had, because I was just so calm. I was very calm, very just content and ready. I was like, this is it. And obviously there was a massive, when I thought of my wife and my boys, there was a huge sense of sadness. But yeah, there was nothing I could do about it. It is what it is.
So it's like surrendering to that moment.
I like that. Yeah, it was. This is what it is. Here we go. And let's see what comes next.
I like I've had this analogy for a while, and it actually worked perfectly because you just explained it like that. But I compare, just like, imagine you jumped out of a plane and your parachute doesn't open. Would you rather enjoy that 2-3 minute fall to the ground, or would you want to freak out and panic?
Yeah.
It's like, okay, you've tried to pull your chute, it doesn't pull. You try to pull your reserve, it doesn't pull. You can see the ground. Are you going to enjoy that last little bit of life, or are you going to freak out and be stressed and angry and sad? And obviously there's part of that comes in, but it's like you said, like, you're at peace and
you enjoy it, yeah. You make the fucking most of that last few seconds.
And
yeah.
I always tell people, like, when you're born, that's you jumping out of a plane. Now, it's going to take a bit longer than 3 minutes to hit the ground, but we all die.
Yep.
We're all falling. We're just falling really slow. So you might as well enjoy it.
Yeah. So true. And we get so caught up on the small things. Like, death is happening. There's fucking no two ways around it. It's happening. Let's make the most of the bits in between. Don't hold grudges. Don't freaking, you know, don't be angry. Don't, you know, fucking live this. Because it is. And it's done. You know, so let's make the most of it. It's certain. So
it's the only thing that's certain.
Yeah, it is. It is. And when you know that and you can use that, it's so powerful. Instead of being fearful of it, instead of using it, you know, be the victim. Oh, I'm going to die. You know, we're all fucking going to die. It's what you make of it before it, you know. So use it as motivation to live life to the fullest. Be healthy. Be happy. Yeah.
Yeah, don't hide from it. I feel like death's such a... it's so hidden to everyone. It's like you get a coffin, you put a body in there, you don't see it, you like don't talk about it, everyone's sad, you wear black. It's just like this dark thing where it's like obviously the funeral's to celebrate someone's life. It's like it should be a celebration. And I know it's hard to feel that when obviously there's a lot of emotion attached, but it's like it should be a beautiful thing. And I think when people do pass away, like there was a guy passed away recently, J.O. Archer.
Yeah, I know J.O.
It just shows you that it can just happen out of nowhere.
Yep.
And we don't know when that is going to come up, ever. It can be out of nowhere. So it's like those things can happen. And like a friend of mine, I was just messaging her today, and she's like, oh, my nan just passed away. Another friend just gone down to Melbourne because his nan's about to pass away. She's in hospital. It's like it's all around us constantly. But we seem to ignore it or hide from it or not embrace it or accept it. It's like that's a thing that's going to happen.
Yeah.
And it's probably going to come quicker than we, like, obviously you don't want to imagine it all the time, but it's just being aware that, yeah, that's like nothing's forever.
Yeah. And that's the real scary thing is when people, like you said, hide it, when we don't accept it. Like, and that's what most people are walking around today, not thinking or not even realization that they could die any minute now, you know, and not living life to the fullest. That's the scary thing. And it's the thing that a lot of people ask me too, you know, after the skydiving accident, and I've had a few close calls, you know, base jumping accident and whatnot. And people are like, ah, so you're going to stop doing that? And even myself, I had a few really like near-death incidences pretty close to together. And I was like, man, am I being too risky or what, you know, what's going on? And it's kind of thinking like, no, like obviously you got to be calculated with the risk you take, you know, not just throwing my life away, but I also like take, you know, like straight after the skydive, I was back jumping 6 days later. I was like, I'm not hiding from this. I'm not stopping. This is what makes me happy. And I'm going to live. I had the realization that, fuck, I don't think I'm living life enough. You know, that was my thing out of it. It wasn't like, oh, I'm going to stop. It was like, I don't think I'm living life enough. I think I need to jump more. You know, I need to do more. I need to forgive more. I need to be open. I need to love and laugh and, you know, live life more. And I feel, unfortunately, a lot of people go through life super comfortable, maybe never have a near-death experience and just cruise on through thinking, hey, I'm going to live forever.
It like re-centers you, hey.
It does, yeah. Yeah, it really does.
My friend Harley, he was talking about when I said my accident.
Clifford?
Yeah, Clifford. I was talking to him about when I had my accident and I had that time when I was like, you kind of realize what's important when I was laying there. And he said, yeah, kind of like having a kid. And I was like, yeah. Because everything you thought you needed to worry about suddenly gets evaporated into nothing.
Yeah.
And you go, I'm worried about one thing. And at that time, it was whether I'd walk again. At that time for him, looking after his kid. And sometimes we need those things to come into our life to go, okay, what I thought was important isn't important. And what is actually important is this.
Yeah.
And then that probably will change how you live your life from that moment on. I know that's how you said you changed how you lived your life from having a kid and having that connection with your wife, and you saw what was important and you actually changed because of that.
Yeah.
But I guess there's a lot of people that don't change because of that, and they almost, they get stuck in this is how it is and this is how it's always going to be.
Yeah.
And it can always be shifted. And I think it's that, like you said, like being able to refocus or shift your, I heard this thing the other day, and it's like your reality, what is it? What did it say? It's something about you can negotiate with your reality or something, and like you can change it.
Yeah.
I think we're all stuck in like, oh, this is my reality. I was like, no, you can negotiate with it.
You can. Yeah, no, I don't know if that's exact analogy, but yeah, I know exactly where you're going with it. And you can. Yeah, people think this is it, and like, no, it's fucking not. Like, you can change anything. Like, even the situation you're in, just the way you perceive it can change. Like, I had one just recently, just surf, you know, a couple of weeks ago, the surf was pumping, it was beautiful out there, but there was no banks, you know, it was a bit straight, but it was good swell, it was just glass, the water was perfect temperature. Usually I'd be like, there's no banks, didn't get many good waves, but I changed my perception and I was just like, look how fucking beautiful this is. Like, I was like, the water's amazing. So I nearly had a tear come down. Like, this is just perfect. Like, you know, and just come in. It was like I just had the best surf of my life. And I did, because my perception of it was that was fucking amazing. Instead of coming in going, I didn't really get that good waves. I was a bit straight, closing out, you know. I was like, that was the best surf of my life. And then I did it day after day after day for like 6 days. I was like, that was fucking amazing. Like, I'm like, how good is it when you look at life that way? So it's definitely the way you perceive anything, you know, is your perception on any situation can completely change the situation.
And you can change that at any time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Any time.
Yeah. We just have so many, unfortunately, we do look at so many things negative, you know, because there's so many negative things around us. Everything's kind of nearly negative, you know, like even social media and like, and you live in an amazing life and you hop on there and you follow a lot of amazing friends. So you hop on there and the first thing you see is your mate in Europe, base jumping off Norway cliffs, and then you see another mate doing this and you're just like, ah, oh, I'm working today. Like, my life sucks. And you start thinking that and it's like, hang on, someone's looking at your Instagram going, how amazing is that person's life? You know, like it's a very double-edged sword that
the comparison piece. Hey?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a very powerful tool, but it can also control you a lot in the old social media and stuff like that. Mm. But
it's funny, the surfing thing. I got out at Snapper a little while ago, and again, like, I didn't have the best surf. And there was this like Brazilian guy, and he comes out, man, and he's just like, "Oh my god, bro!" And he's just like hyped as anything, and he's like, literally, like, couldn't contain himself. He was so happy with how he surfed, and like the waves were good. It was like a nice sunset, and it's, I guess, be that person.
Yeah.
Because instantly I felt like, yeah, this is good, and it, like, it changes your perception because you see someone else just glowing, man, like so excited and so in love with that moment. You go, okay, this is way better than I. And I think you need that. You need people to come into your life that help show you how good your life is.
Mm, yeah.
And you go, oh, wait, this is incredible. Instead of having those people that come in and just go, oh, it's not that good, or oh, my life kind of sucks. Like, you have someone come in, and I guess this comes back to our self-talk about how we can have so much self-doubt in ourselves. And no matter how good we've done something, there's always that little voice that goes, oh, man, I'm probably still going to fail. Oh, this isn't that good. Oh, what am I doing? And that's a hard thing. And I think especially for athletes to turn off, even once you're not competing. And it is a powerful tool because I think it will excel you to be better because you're always going to be critical about what you're doing. But then also it can be kind of devastating because you're never feeling like you're good enough or you've done enough or you can be more. And then sometimes you get someone come into your life and they'll just be like, oh my God, man, like, you've done heaps. This is great. And then you're like, oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, that's all right. And, like, you kind of, reminder. Yeah.
It is. And, like, I love how you said that because I've always said that. It's like, you know, I'm never content or never, you know, grateful, whatever, never content, you know, but I see it as a blessing and a curse, you know, because it does drive you to be better and it does drive you to keep achieving more or wanting more. And, but also, you know, because you don't get that contentment, you're never satisfied, you're never. Like, I remember the first time I had the biggest realization of this is when I did my first base jump. And it's like you do a PCA, so someone holds your pilot chute. So all you got to do is jump off and do your perfect body positioning, you know. You don't have to worry about pitching your parachute. And as soon as my canopy opened, you know, you're doing the gnarliest sport in the world. I just jumped off a freaking cliff. I was in Tong Sai in Thailand, most beautiful location. As soon as my canopy opened, I instantly wasn't satisfied. I was like, I need free fall now. You know, and I just remember thinking as I was flying my canopy in, I was like, holy shit, I've got something wrong with me. Like, I just freaking base jumped, which 99.9% of the population would never, ever do. And instantly I wasn't satisfied with it. You know, I need to go higher. I need to get free fall. And I remember thinking like that. But then I was like, it's just a blessing and a curse, you know. And it's taken, that was a long time ago. And I'm only still learning now to be content and with stuff that I do and be appreciative of it, you know, and really accept it. And yeah, that was really amazing. It's a fine line because you don't want to get too soft and then not drive and not, you know, not push for stuff.
Mm.
But it's very nice to actually start to be content with stuff and go, I do have a good life.
Yeah, sit in it for a little bit. Don't
be present. Yeah.
Don't bathe in it for too long. Just embrace it a little
dip
bit.
Dip the toes. Yeah, that was good. That was nice. All right, let's go.
On to the next.
Yeah.
I had a similar thing with, I did a paragliding course.
Yeah.
And I remember the first time I went solo and like shitting it.
It's wild.
Like this is me and this little bit of this paper holding me up at the moment. And went out and obviously did my fly, landed, all good. Heart was going, but it felt great. Second time, not so nervous. By the third time, completely fine. And it comes back to that thing, by you're like, all right, next. And it's that thing about having that, it's like you're not satisfied. You want more. And it's like trying to embrace the fact that it's like, I just paraglided for the first time solo by myself. Like you don't even almost have time to enjoy that moment because it's like you just want to go again and again. But yeah, it's a hard thing, like you said, to balance, like just dip your toe in and then get out and go to the next.
Same with a lot of stuff in life, eh? It's a very fine line of being amazing for you or too much or too less, you know. It's just a very hard balancing act in life. And that's the thing, it is. It's fucking hard. But it's also super fun and super enjoyable, you know. And but it is. It's hard.
I was going to ask you, with all these action sports and fighting and everything, what scares you?
Not having regrets when I finally go, like that's what scares me, like having a regret, not living life to the fullest, not reaching my potential, not being the best husband that I could be, the best father to my boys. That's what scares me, of just not reaching my potential. And it's a good question. There's definitely no activities or anything that scare me. I just, maybe having regrets when it is my time of having regrets. And you know, it's nearly been my time a few times and I was content.
I was going to ask you that. If you went tomorrow or obviously in these other occasions, would you have been content with where you'd gotten to and what you'd done?
Well, when I thought I was going in that last one, I was very content. And right now, like if I unfortunately pass away on the way home right now, I'm the happiest I've ever been in my life right now. I'm definitely content living it.
I think that's
never felt more alive right now. Yeah.
I think that's when you can accept death, hey?
Yeah. Yeah.
When you're at a place where you're like, I've done, obviously there's always more to do, but I had a bit of a moment where I was by myself for a little while. It was when COVID happened. I went up and actually just lived out of my van when COVID started, everything started getting locked down. I lived up at a national park in, it's called Mount Buffalo in Victoria.
Yeah.
And I just lived out of my van for a couple of weeks and pretty much turned the phone off and was like, okay, awesome. This happened. This was like forced retirement. So I'm like, who am I without the riding? It was definitely very introspection kind of thing. A reflection of who I am and what I wanted to do and where I was at. And it was hard at the start. I remember after about 3 or 4 days, very content with not much, like with very little. And I had this moment, I was near this lake, and I can remember it so clearly. You know, you go back to a moment and it's really just a powerful moment. And I just had this acceptance of I'm just completely fine with death, because I'd been so happy and content with everything I'd done up until that point. And I remember getting to that, and it was just like this, again, like a weight of like, why would I be scared of something that, like, you don't know, for one. And like you said, the biggest thing you're scared of is regret. And if you have no regret, then why are you scared? Why are you nervous about it? And it was like this, like, again, like release of like, oh. And just from that point on, it just like hasn't been something that ever fazed me. And then it kind of got tested one time. I was on a plane and they just had really bad turbulence and it started shaking and it was like getting quite out of hand. And I remember sitting on the plane just like, huh? Because I was like, if it crashes, I got no control. And again, it comes back to that surrendering to those moments where you have no control. And it was like, it was actually tested in a live setting, because we can all say, oh, I'm not afraid of death or whatever. But when it kind of push comes to shove, like, are you? And I guess being in that situation, and I guess you in the falling to your death, it's like you find those moments of peace and you go, okay, it's, I'm not bullshitting myself. It's actually a real reality.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah.
It is.
But I was going to ask you as well, what's some of the, if you could go back and talk to your younger self, what advice would you give him?
Yeah. It's so hard, because if I gave myself advice, I'd probably change what I kind of did, and then I wouldn't.
Yeah.
I feel like every fucking minuscule second of my life, every conversation, even this conversation we're having now, is going to affect who I become tomorrow or the next day, you know. And like there's heaps of stuff I'd want to let myself know, but I'm like, would I? Like, would I change that?
We'll change it now. What's the best advice you've ever gotten?
Yeah, don't stress over the small things. Best advice ever got. And that's, I was just about to say, what I probably would tell myself is don't fucking stress over the small things because they really don't matter in the end, you know? Don't stress over the small things. I just can't even say that enough. Like, it really, I think 99% of people's problems are not problems at all. We make them out to be problems and they're just really not. Like you said, we're going to die at one stage. We should, not everyone's going to live, you know? And that's what I'm scared of, is not living. Not as not living as in physically, you know, being alive, not actually living life to the fullest. That's what I'd say to myself. Freaking live. Live life to the fucking fullest. Try everything. Do everything. Don't be scared. Eat every bit of food. Freaking try everything. Like, you never know, you might like it and it might change your life.
Yeah, open the box, see what's inside.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah, and your perception might change completely from doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What's the worst bit of advice you've ever gotten?
Worst bit of advice. Man, why do I find these questions so hard to...
you probably just always got good advice.
Yeah. And worst bit of advice would be to have not put more money into Bitcoin.
You see, it's just skyrocketing at the moment.
Yeah, well, look, yeah. I invested. I'm pretty happy, but...
Oh, you did invest some
money? Yeah. I'm definitely in there, but...
Could have been more.
Hindsight, yeah.
Yeah.
Could have been... I could have flown here on a freaking jet.
How funny is that, though? Like, you've put money in that's obviously done well, so that's a win.
Yeah.
Because it could have been more.
Yeah.
But this comes back to, like... How much? Okay, if you brought 10,000 Bitcoin, oh, I should have bought 20,000 Bitcoin. Oh, yeah. I bought 30,000 Bitcoin. I should have bought 100. Yeah. Like, it's always going to be more. It's a hard thing.
I thought I'd learn to be grateful and content. I'm just going back on my own words.
And then Bitcoin got involved. Yes. No, I do know what you mean, though. Hey, yeah. It's just like, yeah, probably just a little bit more would have
just
been
just a good. Bit more. Yeah. Really, like, advice in all seriousness. Like, one thing I've done in my life is listen to everyone and listen to everything, take it all in, don't believe a fucking thing, you know? I've always let myself open to everything, listen, and even just conversations of people, I always listen, especially people that I can see that are doing well or people that aren't doing well, I listen, take it in, and then I make my own perception of what they say. So there'd be so much advice that I've been given, that I've listened to maybe secondhand, that I've taken in, that I've used, that I might have subconsciously taken or you know, had. And I don't know where I was trying to go with that, but yeah, I just really, everyone's got something to add to your life, whether it be good or bad. I just make sure I take in everything from everyone and listen to everyone, listen to everyone and respect what they've got to say or what, what's happened to them in their life and stuff like that, you know, and take it on hand.
But also process it through your own lens.
Process it, yeah, exactly. Don't believe anything anyone tells you, you know. Do your own research and work it out for yourself.
We kind of touched on this before. Do you remember when the lowest you ever were and what helped you get out of that point?
Yeah, there's definitely been a few times. The lowest I'd ever been. I'm not going to go into the situation of it, but what got me out was my son at the time. I was like, I need to be, like, I was suicidal. Been there a couple times, and he's probably, you know, at the time, at that stage, I only had one son, you know, and he's thinking of him, save me, thinking of not just that, having the strength to not do it because it happened to me, you know, and this is where I go back, I'd never fucking change a thing, because I probably wouldn't be here if my dad hadn't committed suicide. Yeah, so just thinking of my son, thinking I've got so much to offer, to you know, he relies on me. I know how alone I felt in the world without a dad, and I never wanted to leave my boys like that. So, yeah, them, my boys.
Let's flip it. When's the happiest you've ever been, and what's the things that keep you there?
Right, man, right now, I'm, like, seriously so fucking happy right now. I'm about to become a granddad.
It's a young granddad.
Yeah, mate. Twins too, like in 8 days. Like next week, about to have my oldest boys, about to have twins. So yeah, my happiness levels are about to go through the roof again. But just right now, man, like I had a pretty big realization a couple of weeks ago, and just the realization that, like, I am perfect. And I don't mean like perfect, but I am just as I'm meant to be. Imperfection is perfection. Don't sweat the small things. Just, I had this big reminder, just everything. I'm so in love with my wife, my life, my boys, you know, like, it's just, right now I'm happy as. Yeah. It's a nice feeling, actually. I feel so fucking alive right now. It's amazing.
That's so epic. Well, I'm glad you got to come in here when you're feeling on that.
Yeah,
on that high.
You got me.
You start attracting the right people in that state. That's the best thing about it.
You do, yeah.
And you almost question it in a way. You're like, why does all this good shit keep happening to me? And you're like, oh, that's because of me. I'm doing that.
Yeah, and this is what I was trying to say before, getting into a little bit before, about the positive attraction, you know. When you're negative, it feels like everything always happens, you know. Like when you're down and you stub your toe, then your car breaks down and fucking something else happens, you know. Like, oh, everything's happening to me, and it's so easy to get stuck in that. When you turn that around and you're just, everything good happens to me, freaking everything good happens. Even if maybe it wasn't that good, you still feels good, you know. Like, I just had my van, the door stuffed up the other day, and I had to get that, the electric door on the Sprinter van, and they're like, oh, we need to pull out all the, it's all fully set out, you know, like a motorhome inside. I have to pull all the cupboards and everything out, and I was just like, oh, man, this is gnarly, like, you know, your gas cooker and all that. And then I was kind of like, no, I wanted to change the bench top anyway. So, yeah, here I go, and I'll change the bench top. And I sat up to like 10 o'clock at night, threading screws and bumping my head, and I just like enjoyed it. And I was like, man, that was so much easier than being angry the whole time and being annoyed. It's like, man, this is life's so much easier.
Well, it comes back to, it's all a choice, man.
Yeah.
It's like, you're going to have to do it anyway. And like, you choose whether you want to be pissed off in a situation or happy in a situation.
Yep.
And just because you react through programming and through circumstance and all that, it's like you can stop at any moment. And it is harder the more emotion you have attached to something, but you still have the choice.
You can, yeah.
110% you have the choice.
Yeah.
And I guess that comes back to knowing yourself and doing the things that feed your soul and living to your values that make it easier to make that choice. But still, it's all a choice at the end of the day.
Yep, 100%, yeah. And it is, like I said, you need to keep... You know, as happy as I am right now, I feel everything's perfect and it never, you know, everything's bliss. But I know there's shit times coming, you know. It's just how I react to them. And I feel I'm learning more tools, and I've got more ammo behind me to help me through these times, you know.
As accepting that in, like, both sides of that, like you're saying, you're super happy, everything's great, but it's like a shit time will come. But in that shit time, holding on to a really good time is going to come.
Mm.
And it's that constant back and forth between the two, ebbs and flows and all of it. It's just like, it's like enjoying the good times and learning from the bad times.
Yeah, exactly.
And knowing that they're both going to come and go.
You can actually enjoy, like I said, you nearly said it, like enjoying the bad times kind of, you know. Yeah, you can enjoy bad times because like you get good stuff out of it.
You touched on it before. It's like, I always compare it to like a life vest. And when you're in those really shit times, when you're as low as you can be, and the mindset of knowing that it will bounce back and have its equal opposite effect as a positive, that's my life vest.
Mm.
And I know, like, whoa, this sucks. It's, the seas are rough. I'm by myself. I'm a bit cold. I'm a bit lonely. But, like, you just hold onto that life vest, man, and eventually you'll come out of it.
Yeah, you're going to float to paradise. You're going to float to this beautiful tropical island, and it's going to be amazing.
But if you take off that life vest or that positive way of knowing that it's going to get better, like, you'll sink.
Yeah.
So you just got to hold on to that fucking life vest as hard as you can.
Yeah, for sure, man.
I was going to ask you, I know we finished with this, but how do you want to be remembered?
I want to be remembered as an amazing dad. I want to leave an impact. I want to be remembered that I did my part in making the world a bit of a better place. Like, just having an impact on people's lives, especially my families. Yeah. It's another reflective kind of question, isn't it? That I don't know if people think about it much. I definitely haven't. But
it comes back to the whole we kind of hide from death.
Mm.
And then you put that question out there and it puts your death in your face because you're like, whoa, when I'm gone, like, what's after that?
Yeah. Most importantly to me is I just want my boys and my family, my wife, to remember me as a good person, as the man that I actually am, because I know I am. So, yeah.
And the thing I also tell people, because it's one of those things that stumps you, but at the same time, I always say, like, well, how do you live every day? And if you live to, like, your values and you live to that way, I'm like, well, that's how you're remembered.
Yeah.
It's like how you show up in the world is how you're going to be remembered, and you just kind of have to look at, well, how do I show up? I'm like, well, that's how I'm going to be remembered.
Yeah. It was funny because as you were about to say that, I kind of was like, oh, I just want to be remembered by my wife and my sons as a good man because I am. And I'm like, yeah, I just want to be remembered as I am.
Yeah. Like, yeah, exactly.
Right now.
Yeah,
like
the
happiest I've ever been. Luke,
yeah.
Right now.
Yeah.
I want to be remembered as that.
Yeah.
Boom. There you go. No. Done.
That's good. I was going to say, before we go, where are people going to be able to find the film when it's going to be, you said, launched in probably June?
Or, yep. Yeah. Around June. We've got no set date at the moment. We're still kind of in the midst of getting distribution and everything like that at the moment. But we're looking at having the premiere here at Hoda. It'll be all over the socials. We're on Instagram, Impact Movie. Our website is impactdoco.com. And then, through my Instagram, you'll be able to see kind of all the promotion for it. It's definitely going to be around June. We'll be trying to release it, yeah.
If this one takes off and has a reaction that you would hope for, do you want to do more?
I want to do anything that's going to help people and inspire people. If anyone out there needs a hand, send me a message. Anyone needs a chat, send me a message. I'll do anything to help put my impact on the world and help people and get through this journey that we call life that can sometimes be very freaking hard. So, yeah, I'm more than open, yeah.
Is that kind of tied in with the name Impact and the whole, like, you want to have an impact? Is that kind of the play on words?
The name of that come by because obviously the noun of impact is two objects colliding, which is the accident, and then the verb of impact is the effect that it has on everything. And when we first sat down for me and Benny and the filmmaker, we wanted to come up with the title, and I went to bed that night, and you know when you have those dreams where you're just repeating like one word over in your head, and it's just like, I don't even think I slept a wink that night, but I was just, this word kept repeating in my head, and then when I woke up in the morning, it's kind of like, what the fuck was that word? And I was like, impaction, impactful, and I'm like, impact. And I kind of just like went, impact. I was like, man, I looked it up, and seeing the noun and the verb, I was like, perfect. Like, it is the epitome of everything. And then I'm really using that word. I want my impact on the world. And
that's what you said. You said it tied in with that. Yeah. I was like, that's a good play on words with everything you're doing.
It does. It really does. It plays in with who I am. Yeah. I want to impact, leave my impact.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, Mike, well, I really appreciate you coming on. Vanessa was definitely steered me in the right direction for it. I think, again, like, very similar values of just, trying to help people. And I think, like you said, the two ways people go is if they have something rough or hard happen to them, they either become their situation and become that victim, or use it as a tool to become a hero and help other people to become a hero in their own life. So
yeah,
I really appreciate you coming on and having a chat about everything.
My absolute pleasure, man. Thank you for giving me a platform to share my stories and get it out there. And yeah, hopefully this can help someone or inspire someone, or you can have a laugh at me. Of with me, whatever you want to do.
Good as that. So, hey, brother. Cheers for that.
Cheers, man.
I have to come jump out of a plane with you soon.
Yeah, man. Anytime. Bring it on.
Sweet. Cheers, Mike.
Cheers, bro.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.